Good afternoon. My name is Mark Evanier. This is the 70s panel. Let me explain a few things. First, I would like to just mention something which is vaguely relevant to people in this room. We are giving out tonight a thing called the Bill Finger Award at the awards ceremony. For those of you who don't know, this is an award that is given out annually for recognition for writers of the body of work of writers who have not received adequate attention in their careers, either that of rewards monetarily or in terms of recognition. And Bill Finger, the late Bill Finger, qualified obviously in both categories. Tonight we're presenting two of them. One of them is to Bob Haney, who you probably all know what he did, but he wrote Batman and Teen Titans and Brave and Bold and, you know, everything for DC over the years, Metamorpho certainly. And that award will be presented, accepted on his behalf posthumously by Ramona Frayne, who's collaborator on Metamorpho. The other award we're giving is kind of interesting to me. I wanted to tell you a little about this because we'll meet some of the people who come to a panel like this. We're presenting the award to a man named Del Cannell. How many people in this room know who Del Cannell is? All right? Del Cannell wrote more comic books than everybody in this room put together. Del Cannell wrote thousands of comic books. Total number of them he got his name on, zero. He was one of the most prolific writers for Western Publishing on the Dell Comics over the years. He started off as a Disney animator. He was one of the storymen on Alice in Wonderland, Lady and the Tramp, and Make My Music. He later started writing for Dell Comics. Later, he created a comic called Space Family Robinson for them. He did a comic called, started the Supergroup comic. He was mainly a Disney writer. And I just got an email from his son, and he's not up to coming tonight. So we're going to present it in absentia. Dell is 94. He's in a nursing home. But I would really appreciate it if those of you who go to the awards ceremony, even those who don't, would spread a little word on the internet about this man. He never got any recognition. He's 94 years old. This was the chance we were going to have. Tonight would have been the first time he ever got up on a podium and had people applaud him for his work at age 94. I'm a little sad he's not going to be there, but give us a hand with this. Let's tell the world about Del Cannell. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this panel. We do not this year have a Golden Age panel at this convention. We didn't have one last year. I don't think we will ever have one again. I don't have enough people to fill it. This year, as far as I can tell, there are only three people who have set foot in this building who would qualify for a Golden Age panel. One is Jerry Robinson, who has been the subject of the spotlight. One of them is Stan Lee, who doesn't do these kinds of panels. And one of them is Ramona Frayne, who is a lovely, wonderfully talented woman, but she is not a panel on her own. So when they needed space, in the schedule for a Gene Colan tribute, I said, okay, let's cancel the Golden Age panel. I don't have anybody to put on it anyway. We'll do the Gene Colan tribute. That time slot. We were going to have a Silver Age panel. I couldn't fill it either. It's not that these people are all dying on us. Most of them, a lot of them are around, they just don't come to conventions anymore because they don't have current product out to sell, and it's quite a bit of energy for an older person to come to one of these conventions. It tires them out. So, this brings us... Here go the 70s panel. And we're going to do one of these at every convention until such time as I can't fill it or I pass away, at which time we'll start the 80s panel. Anyway, let me introduce you to the 70s panel. This is Walt Simonson, ladies and gentlemen. That's Maureen Simonson. Her is Roy Thomas. Next to Roy is Mike Royer. Next to Mike is Len Wein. Joe Staten. Now, I submit to you that there is a dividing line between 70s people and the generation before us that is not just in terms of years, that is not just in terms of what comics we worked on, what companies we worked for. There is a difference in attitude about people who did comics in the 70s. Different approach. We were a generation. I divide this up this way. To me, the Silver Age ended the day I got into the business. in before me is Silver Age. Unless it's Roy, who overlapped a couple of generations. I think those of us who did comics in the 70s came to the work with a different attitude, a different expectation of the industry. In some cases, in the early 70s, a feeling, gee, this business ain't going to be around for very long, so I'll enjoy it while I can. I would like to ask each person on the panel a question of when you started working in comics. Tell us the first assignment, in some cases it wasn't in the 70s per se, but tell us your first assignment, and tell us what your attitude was about being a comic book writer or artist or editor at that point. Did you see it as a career? Did you see it as a stepping stone? Did you see it as like working at McDonald's when you were a kid before you get a real job? Would someone like to jump on this question, or should I just force someone? Walt, why don't you start first?
Sure. I don't remember all those questions. My first job was for DC Comics. It was what I gathered was an inventory script because it was sitting in a drawer written by Len Wein. It was a short story called Cyrano's Army. It went in the back of Weird War number 10 with a lead-off story by Alex Toth, which was, if nothing else, incredibly intimidating. But I was too young to know the difference back then, so it was okay. I got the job because Carmen Infantino, who was the editor-in-chief or editorial director, whatever his title was at the time, at DC Comics, got a look at my work pretty much by accident, really liked it, and forced three of his editors to give me short stories in the back of their comics. Joe Orlando was one of the editors he forced to give a job, me to give a job to me. Joe gave me that short story. I will say that many of us in my generation, me and Howard Chaykin and Alan Milgram and a bunch of the guys, we all hung out together in New York City. At that time, you pretty much had to move to New York to get into mainstream comics. No internet, no FedEx, no faxes, no none of that stuff. The result was we talked a lot about the industry, and all of us pretty much thought that the industry was dying. Every month, the sales figures would come in. The percentage of sell-through on the newsstand would be a little bit less than it had been the month before. And so we all thought we wanted the new comics. We loved comics. We had read comics in the 60s. We all read different books. We all loved them. We wanted to do them because we thought it was a great thing to do. We didn't look at it as just a job of doing, you know, flipping burgers. We also thought that we would have maybe 5 or 6 years before we had to get a real job once comics collapsed and disappeared. So none of us, I don't know how many of us, I certainly did not think of it as a long-term career. I thought maybe I'd do it for 4 or 5 years, and by which time I would have done all the stuff I could possibly do or be interested in doing. I'd go out and find something else, I don't know what, to do. In my case, the 4 or 5 years stretched into a good deal longer than that. I'm not going to admit to how many. But basically, it worked out great. We were quite wrong about how comics were going to go. One of the things none of us foresaw was the development and the expansion of the direct market, which made a very big difference the way comics were sold. And it made a huge difference in our careers. And most of us were able to keep our careers far longer than any of us had any dreams of doing.
And Walt, you said you figured you'd do it for a couple of years and you'd go off and get a real job. What did you then think that real job would be? Would it be a drawing illustration job? Would it be a drawing something else? Or would it be
I didn't have any real clear ideas. The thing was that I had been in college. I'd been a geology major. My dad was a scientist. I had an interest in becoming a paleontologist and studying dinosaurs. I graduated from college and I went to art school, but I blew off grad school to get into comics. I don't know if I would have gone back in that direction. I was 22 or 3 or 4. I didn't have a clear idea of the future, so I hadn't really carefully planned out my escape from comics into some other area. I just thought I'd probably have to go out and get some actual job, because really being paid money to draw stories was, it just seemed too much like a dream. So it was great. I was thrilled. And fortunately, the dream lasted a lot longer than I thought. But I had not really considered exactly what I would be doing 5 years hence. I just thought it probably wouldn't be comics. I imagine it would have something to do with drawing in some way, but I didn't have to worry about that.
When you walked around the DC offices and you saw, you know, there's Bob Brown walking around, there's George Tesco walking around, there's Kurt Small walking around, did you say to yourself, I'm not one of those guys? Did you think of like, oh, I don't want to wind up like one of those guys? What was your attitude towards the artists you grew up on?
I was wowed by most of them. The first time I was at DC, which was a couple of years before I got into the business, I met Neil Adams. Neil was still doing some work up there. Neil has a very powerful personality for those of you who met him. He was doing his Green Lantern, Green Arrow work at the time, so I saw some of those go by in the office in the originals. I thought it was just fantastic. I loved it. A lot of the guys I knew, the guys I hung out with, my generation, I have to say, we thought of the guys ahead of us, I don't know exactly with awe, but we were really, we loved what they did. We thought it was fantastic. I didn't think I was anywhere in that league when I began. I really thought I was somewhere, you know, I was a novice. I was just starting out. I couldn't draw like those guys. I couldn't tell stories. But I was still willing to give it a shot. So they were inspirational. You know, some more than others. I mean, we'll have a panel later about this with Mark. But you know, I was a major Jack Kirby fan. I was a big Roy Thomas fan. I was a big fan of Marvel Comics. There were a lot of weird things that DC did in the early 70s, in the late 60s. I thought were fantastic. Joe Kubert, all those guys, I thought were just great. I'm still trying to be as good as most of those guys. So the one thing I will say that I observed as a reader was that there were some artists who've been doing comics a long time, and you could see that they were doing kind of the same thing that they had been doing for a long time. And I was a little afraid of being in the, you know, even though I thought I'd be out of the business in 5 years, once it became clear I wasn't going to be, I tried to work hard so that the work that I did not eventually seem to become formulaic. I do not know if I've been successful doing that, but the way I work is an attempt to try and make each job fresh at the time I do it. And that was something I did learn from some of the professionals that I saw whose work I thought was good, but still seemed locked in an earlier time. I now see comments on the web about, you know, Simon's some pretty good, man, really 80s stuff. So apparently I'm not as successful as I thought I was. So there you are.
Let's ask Louise. What was your first real professional job in comics, and what did you think about being in the industry?
All right, my first real job in comics was working at Warren. I was hired from McFadden Bartel, which is a magazine publisher. I had a friend who worked at Warren, and she said, "You know what? Why don't you come apply for this job because it pays better than your job?" And I had read the Warren books and loved them. So, especially those really early ones, remember those? Wow. So, I applied and I got the job. I was in, Warren was a very small company, and they needed hands to do everything that needed doing. So, and I liked doing a variety of things, so that when they needed ad copy written, I'd say, I can do that, and I could. And letters, I can do letters pages, I can do, you know, whatever. And eventually they just moved me over from production. I was not great at production, let's face it. Over into editorial where they created an assistant editor position for me. And then later on I moved up as, senior editor at the Warren Books. I was delighted. I didn't think of it exactly as a career, but I'd always wanted to write and to deal with writers. Being a writer was beyond my dreams, but working with writers was, oh boy, I'm so excited. And working with artists, the same thing. It was like, oh wow, I'm just the luckiest person in the world. But it never occurred to me that it would last. I mean, I was just, but I felt very lucky while I was there. I was going to go along for the ride.
If one day Jim Warren came in and said, okay, we're going out of business, we're scolding.
He did.
Okay, all right.
Actually, I left, but I could see the ship sinking.
Okay.
So I went to work at Marvel.
All right.
Okay.
You answered my question here, basically. But you, at some point you thought, well, I'm going to spend the rest of my career in comics as long as I can. Mm-hmm. And if that can't pay, I'll look for something else. Did you find that, now you were dealing, I think, at Warren at that point, with a lot of new people, for the most part?
I brought in a lot of new people when I was an editor there.
Yes.
But I was also dealing with the Lexanas Illustratus people, the Spaniards,
okay,
whose work was wonderful. And you know, we sent some of the older guys, too, so it was a beautiful mix of talent. You know, Alex Toth, anything from Alex Toth to, I don't know, like brand new Spaniards whose work I'd never seen before, but I thought were fabulous.
And did you find that people walked into Warren kind of in the shadow of what came before? It's like people walked in and said, oh, I can't equal what Archie Goodwin did, or I can't equal what Richard Corbin did.
Nobody seemed to have that attitude. Everybody seemed to be quite pleased with what they were doing, actually. They certainly respected what Archie did and what Richard Corbin did. I mean, they were in awe of it, but it wasn't like they were exactly comparing themselves to it in any kind of negative way. They were just delighted to be allowed into the same play box that these guys were.
And when you got over to Marvel, what was different about Marvel from working for Warren?
It was a much bigger pool. I don't know. In some ways I had more freedom, in some ways I had less freedom. Working at Warren was great. because the company was very small. I had three regular magazines that I edited, plus, you know, occasional annuals and that sort of thing. And I could do virtually anything I wanted there. So I mean, I was like the little goddess of Warren for a while, and it was really fun. I could hire who I wanted, pretty much. I mean, Warren would occasionally object, and then I'd have to go in and have an argument with him about whether or not this person was acceptable, and usually I'd win.
Not to ask him who the people were, but what was the criteria he was using for not liking something?
I couldn't tell whether he had breakfast that morning. Who knows? You know, I think sometimes Warren loved to push people's buttons, so that if he thought he could push my button by turning somebody down, well, then he would do that, because it was fun for him to push my buttons and make me mad. And we had a discussion about that at one point. It was like he loved to also yell at people. And he yelled at me once, and I said, look, I said, you may yell about things, but you may not yell at me. And he said, okay, and that was our relationship. And it worked out fine. I was very fond of him in kind of a strange sort of way. I loved it that he would go away during the summer. He would just leave me in charge totally. And I could run experiments on my readers to see what would make them write one kind of letter or another. It was a beautiful, fabulous learning experience. And then he would come in at the end of summer, and everything that we had done was wrong. And he would, it was like a gorilla, like the alpha male gorilla, leaving the herd to go off and do his thing, and then coming back, and then beating his chest, and bumping down all the other little gorillas, just to prove how important he was. And then he would create problems, he would then solve them, and he would say, why didn't you think of that? And after a while, I learned to say, gosh, you really are wonderful. Wow, how smart you are. And you know, it worked. And then he would go away again. It was fabulous. I loved working at Warren. So it was less easy, maybe, at Marvel, because of course Jim Shooter was, I don't know, he didn't go away.
Loan your microphone to Roy. Please.
Sorry.
No.
You can hide.
Right.
You should pull me.
That's fine. Roy, at what point in your career did you think, I'm going to stay in comics for a long time?
Oh, the minute I got in, I was determined to stay. I never thought about getting back out. I had hated teaching so much that, you know, I had this fellowship to George Washington University in foreign relations I could have gone back to for the first few months. And actually, I would never have been available for the job if 2 years earlier I had had the money to go to the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute in Egyptology. I would never got into comics, even though I would have always rather been in comics. It just never occurred to me that some kid from Missouri could end up working in New York. I knew that everybody sort of lived there, and I didn't live there, and I was never adventurous enough to have moved there looking for a job. If I hadn't been invited to New York with a job offer, I just wasn't adventurous enough or ambitious enough to do it. I was basically just a guy drifting through life, you know, doing teaching and hating it and so forth. This is about the 1970s.
Yeah.
I thought it was a panel for me because I'm 70. You know, I thought everybody on the panel would be 70. I'm the only guy here that deserves to be here.
I don't think of you as 70. You don't look
really
70. Maybe your IQ. I don't know. But
what was that? I missed that.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so see. Anyway, but I think it. I was the reason I asked you to be on this panel is I thought that you did such important work in the 70s. I think of you as a 70s guy because I think in the 70s was when you stopped being Stan's assistant and you started being the head of the company and the guy who's doing Conan and.
I never stopped being Stan's assistant. If you didn't believe me, ask him. No, I remember Don Rico got to be a good friend of mine. Remember Don Rico? He wrote a couple of stories for Marvel, good artist, and so forth. He wrote a Doctor Strange story once, and so forth. Nice man. And sometime he says, you know, since I was up at Marvel, you know, this was back in the early 70s when I was there. He was telling me about it several years later. He said, I went in right after Stan became publisher in 1972, and I went in and I talked to him, and I said, and he says, hey, guess what, Don, I'm the publisher and president now. I says, great, well, who's the editor? He says, oh, some guy out there, you know, but I didn't take offense because, you know, Len had that job, Marv, Archie, even Shooter for a while, you know, we were just all some guy out there, you know, whoever was out there, you know, was all right, and that I was determined to be the guy out there. I got into it. Steve Skates was already there before me, so it's not even. I immediately came in as number two assistant writer, you know, secondary writer. So I never had any plans to do anything, but I was never thinking about. I'd have gone back to teaching, I guess, or something, if the fellowship would run out, if it had gone sour. But I knew that comics had been considered before a dying field. I'd heard that from Otto Binder when I was briefly at DC about, you know, everybody said, don't get into comics, it's a dying field. But once I was in, you know, it's like that line in Chorus Line where the singer is walking around and says, don't tell me Broadway's dying, I just got here, you know. And that's the way I felt about comics. And I never thought about doing anything else. I have no other skills, as far as I know, since teaching obviously wasn't one of them. So, you know, that's what my wife tells me. If I didn't believe it, my wife Dana would tell me, is that you can't do anything else, so it's a good thing. You can write these comic books, you know. And that's okay, because if you can just do one thing and do it halfway decently, that hopefully will carry you through. But by the 70s, I was already a veteran, I guess, 5 years in there and everything. But the 70s were a time to flourish because... you know, I gained a little stature and a little power without trying to and everything. And I sort of peaked in the comic book, I suppose, in 1972 to 74 as editor-in-chief. I've been going downhill ever since, you know. But it's been a long, slow descent. And, you know, I've still managed to, you know, keep in a little bit here and a little bit there. And, you know, I feel if I have to write one more comic book in my entire life in order to secure what little tiny... you know, a niche, we all have a little niches, you know, in comic book, well, it's already too late for me, see? You know, I've either done it or not do it. We can go on and do some other nice things and have fun with it, but, you know, we've already had, you know, how many novels did Joseph Heller have to write besides Catch-22, you know, or something? How many epics did Homer have to write? We're not in that class, but we just do what we can and keep working at it. But I just never thought about getting out of the comics. My whole idea was, how do I stay in it? And I never thought it was going to die, because I knew it was kind of coming back thanks to what Julie had done first and what Stan did. And it actually did kind of start declining, you know, by the late 70s and so forth. And somehow or other, Jim Galton always said that I saved the company with Star Wars or something. He never told me that. He told other people that. Actually, what he said was I made him rich, which I said, well, then why didn't you give me some of it? You know, I never got anything out of Star Wars.
Mike? Seems to me you had a couple interesting encounters with Jim Warren as well.
Yes, I love those stories.
Do you want to talk about some of that?
Well, I want to tell you that one of the great thrills of my life was riding a 5-year-old Mustang Paint at a full gallop between the Mittens and Monument Valley as a movie Saturday matinee kid. To ride where Ben Johnson wrote for the Buffalo Herd was fantastic. But now I got to say, it is such a privilege and an honor to be sitting here at the table with all of these talented people. I wonder, what am I doing here? But my first encounter...
Right. Let's get Mike off the panel. I'm sorry.
When I was a kid, I just wanted to draw comics. I didn't care what it was. I just wanted to draw comics. And I drew a really... poorly crude version of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Carson of Venus and took it to the World Science Fiction Convention in 64 because I wanted to meet Russ Manning. And I discovered in fandom that he was a Tarzan fan, and I assumed, well, by golly, he'll be there. Well, he wasn't. But Camille Casness, who the editor of Urban was, and he went to visit Russ, talked about me, wrote me and says, send him some samples. I sent Russ samples, and he wrote me back and he said, if I ever needed an assistant, you would fit the bill. So I packed up my family, told the people I was working for that I was taking a month vacation to California, and I said, I'm not going to come back. I moved into Russ's backyard, and bless his heart, he gave me work. And through Russ, I met several artists who were the backbone of Western publishing in the Dell / later Gold Key comic books. They're all unknowns, but these guys were my mentors. And they told me at that time in the 60s, and it was through the 70s, that you got your first job in comic books on your ability, and every job after that was on your dependability. Mm-hmm. So I had some great mentors, Mike Aarons, Doug Wildey, Sparky Moore, Hi Mankin, all of these great guys on the West Coast. And I seem to have had a run of luck. I had a real job as a paint salesman and credit manager for Sherwin-Williams, and on nights and weekends I worked with Russ. And then Russ says, you know, they're looking for somebody at Grant Ray Lawrence Animation to work on Marvel Superheroes. So I went in and met Mike Ahrens, got a job, and worked on all that stuff where he adapted from the comic book pages, and then on Submariner did new artwork because not enough stuff had been published yet. 11 months later, Gold Key Comics wanted more art out of Russ Manning, and they said, well, the only way I can do it is with a full-time assistant, but I can't pay him enough for a full-time living. So Gold Key called me and said, would you like to come in and pick up work?
Oh, nice.
So that's how I ended the 60s, and looking at fanzines and thinking, why don't I ever see anybody inking Jack Kirby? And then one night I get a phone call. He says, Mike Royer, this is Jack Kirby. Alex Holt says you're a pretty good inker. And that's how my career in the 70s was pretty much just inking and lettering Jack Kirby. And all this time, I still wanted to draw superheroes and adventure stuff. But it wasn't until 79 that I found out what my real bag was. And if you want to find out, come by booth 5112. For 35 years, I've drawn mice and ducks and mermaids and Dumbos and
Pooh Bears.
And poo. Oh, lots of poo. But I never had the feeling that the comics were doomed. It was just do the best damn job you can, and if everybody's doing that, we'll survive. And there was a lot of great stuff, in my opinion, that came out of the 70s. And I knew as a kid that as far as comic books were concerned, the world ended at the Hudson River. So if I was going to be in comic books, I had to be in Los Angeles, where Western Publishing was. And then thanks to Russ and his kind-heartedness, that's where I wound up. And then guys like Alex Soth and Mark Evanier recommended it to Jack Kirby. And, you know, I found I could do something which kind of put aside learning a lot more about what I wanted to draw. And then the realization that, God, I'd rather draw Mickey Mouse than Superman.
Do you want to tell a Jim Warren story? Will you work for Jim Warren?
Oh, the last job... Well, I did some pretty bad work for Jim Warren. Well, you know, I was...
He deserved it.
I was learning.
He probably did.
And I think one of the most fun jobs I had was a story that Len wrote. And I got to play with some psychedelic stuff. But my Jim Warren story is the last job I did for Jim Warren. I went to a stat office, paid a fortune to get photostats made of all the original art, sent him the original art, and then I get this phone call.
You sent him the photostats, not the original.
Not the original art, I'm sorry. I sent the photostats, and then I get this phone call from a very irate Jim Warren saying, how the hell could you unilaterally make the decision to send me photostats? I cannot work for these things. So I thought, well, I'm not going to get a check if I don't comply, so I sent the original art. But in the meantime, between sending the stats and the original art, I had tweaked the original art. And as soon as the magazine was printed, I realized that he printed it from the stats.
It's so Warren.
Here, Luis just said, that's so Warren.
It is. Mind games.
At one point.
That's a great story.
I'll just mention here, because parenthetically, Mike talked about dependability and such. I worked with Mike off and on for many years in Washington. I have never in my life seen the two most on-time artists in the world I ever saw in my life were Dan Spiegel and Mike Royer. And I don't think anybody ever, Mike, did you ever miss a deadline in your life?
No, I got my first house as a freelancer getting a mortgage loan from Bank of America on the strength of a letter from Gold Key Comics editor Chase Craig that said, we set our clocks, by Mike Royer.
Wow, nice.
You point out that lettering and inking Jack Kirby as fast as Jack drew is something that an awful lot of artists could not do at all, let alone do that well. They just could not get that much work done. Len, tell us the first job you had in comics and what you thought about the business at that time.
Well, by a weird coincidence, the first story I ever wrote was this thing called Cyrano's Army that Walt Simonson. it's a toss-up.
Len, will you tilt the microphone up a little close, much and get closer to it, please?
It's actually a toss-up. It was for DC Comics, and it was either an issue of Teen Titans, which I co-wrote with Marv Wolfman, or it was a two-page Jerry Lewis story that I co-wrote with Marv, both of which came out the same week, one on Wednesday and one on Friday, back in the days when comics came out twice a week from the stores. I always assumed there'd be a comic book business. I only ever wanted to be in comics. From the time I was 7 years old, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a comic book person of whatever sort. And in the eighth grade, I had an art teacher who told me I could draw. And I said, great, then I'll be a comic book artist. And I devoted my entire education to majoring in art, becoming an artist. And I finally turned in samples, and they said, an artist, you're a pretty good writer. And I'm a writer ever since. But I always believed there would be a business because I wanted there to always be a business for me to be in.
Tell us about someone telling you there wouldn't be.
Well, I had an argument with Howard Chaykin 30-odd years ago about that, where I said, don't be absurd, of course there'll always be a comic book business. It's an American staple. And Howard's immediate response was, really? How much your boogie whip stop these days? And I kind of went, oops, but I never thought anything would change. I do want to tell a story about working for Wheezy at Ward, because I always thought, you were the shrewdest woman I've ever worked for.
Okay.
As you may well recall, Ward paid duty. To use a polite phrase, their patrons are terrible. But you would call me up every so often and ask me to write a story. Mm-hmm. And I would go, how the Patriots better? And you would go, no. Then I would go, but I can't do it for you. And you would go, well, all right, I guess I have to hire someone else to join that John Severin job. And I just thought, what's it do? And I did it with Alex Nino, and I remember a guy, who would call up, and suddenly I discovered I'd be working with them. And so I kept doing these stories for Warren for camp fair, basically. Mm-hmm. Not even camp fair, bus fair.
Yeah. Actually, what was interesting about Warren is that the artists got paid pretty decent wages, but the writers didn't. I don't know. Maybe it was because back in the olden days, they got Archie kind of for free since he got the editor, mm-hmm. writer for the same rate, and he just couldn't see why anybody should be paying writers a lot of money. Well, we make, what, $25 a page or something like that?
That's
what I'm...
A story?
Yeah,
for a while,
story. Okay,
yeah. When I was there, we were paying $25 a page.
Okay, it was still not what I was getting.
It was probably a half of what you were getting elsewhere.
Not even that.
Oh, jeez.
When I was asked to write for Warren in 1970, it was $25 a story. Uh-huh. But if a story was nine pages, it was considered two stories. So an eight-page story paid $25, a nine-page story paid $50. And what happened is everybody would write these nine-page stories, and Warren would cut them down to eight pages.
So Warren.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't know what year it was that Jim Warren was on the TV show To Tell the Truth, but that's where three guys end up saying, my name is Jim Warren. Well, I saw the show. I don't now remember whether he was number two or number three. But the last time I went to a convention in New York, I was no longer doing any work for him. I'd been with Jack a while. And we're opposite, we're in this lobby with all these elevators with a mass of people emptying out. And Jim Warren is like where that exit sign is there. And I yelled across, I said, Jim, I saw you To Tell the Truth. I voted for number three.
There's an episode of To Tell the Truth which Robert Canada was on. It was about Wonder Woman, the revival of Wonder Woman, and you know, one of these men is the writer of Wonder Woman. And Canada got every question wrong. The bosses got every question right. And because it was like they'd ask him, well now, who created Wonder Woman? And Canada would say, well, what's to say what created beings? What is it? And he would start philosophizing and dodging the question. Joe, same question for you. What was your first job in comics, and what did you think that the future of the business was at that point?
My first job in comics was a Charlton ghost story. It was called The Curse of the Hanging Man for, I think, Ghost Manor. It was written, of course, by Joe Hill. It was everything that Charlton was. I got that job on April 19th of 1971, which was the day after I got married, which is why I remember that. I was of two minds always about comics, going to conventions and just hearing what's going around. I was sure comics would be shutting down any day now, and I just wanted to work in it as long as I could, because that's all I wanted to do. And on the other there had been actual serious talk, interviews with Alex Toth and things like that in those fanzines, which had convinced me that there was real worth to doing comics, that there was a possibility. And I've always been torn. Is comics going to shut down any minute now? Or is something of real worth going to be done? And, you know, both things are still true. So, as best I can tell. And it's the only thing I'm wanting to do. And I'm always amazed that I'm still doing it.
What was your page rate for Charlton when you started? It's my mom, I'm not here.
I would pencil and letter a page. I believe it was for $25 a page. I may have gotten an extra couple of dollars for the lettering.
But you could have probably stayed there as long as Charlton was still in business, right?
Well, actually, we met Glenn. He called up one day and asked if I'd like to take the Avengers.
but you could have stayed at Charlton. Just a lot of guys just stayed there.
I stayed at Charlton. I was never quite sure when I was no longer working in Charlton. I kept on doing work while I was working for Marvel. And I assume at some point it just got to where I couldn't fit in more Charlton stuff. So I never actually was aware that I wasn't working for Charlton anymore.
Do you know that now?
I do know that now.
Tell the people, just because I don't know if everybody else is, what you are drawing now.
I'm drawing the Dick Tracy Daily and Sunday newspaper strip.
Yay!
How did you feel about the other artists in the business? The older timers, you work within the business, and there's John Buscema, and there's Gene Colan, and there's, you know, John. Did you say to yourself, I want to wind up being like those guys, or I don't want to wind up being like those guys? What was your view of those people as role models, not for artists, as artists, but as careers?
I realized that guys like Kubert and Gil Kane had worked at this for a very long time, and had a body of work, and I would see them as role models that keep on doing it, to, you know, and have something to show for it.
Briefly, my first published comic in this country was an issue of The Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan, drawn by Warren Tufts.
Wow.
If you don't know who that is, you should know who that is. And I never wanted to get into comics full time because I kept thinking you couldn't. I lived in Los Angeles. And every interview I ever read to a comic book artist or writer or anything said, you gotta live in New York. I don't want to have to live in New York. I just want to all write TV shows, all write cartoon shows, things like that. And the opportunity for comics kept presenting itself to me. Mike Royer and I spent a lot of time recommending each other for work, and Mike helped me get into writing Disney comics and things like that. And I just never got into it because I didn't see. I met Jack Kirby early on, and Jack basically said to me, I've done about as well as you can do a comic. I think that great. Jack Kirby isn't, you know, happy in the business and getting paid enough to have a lot of money in the bank. Maybe it's not like I'm going to do a better job than he did. So maybe I ought to go someplace else. So I'm still to this day amazed that I was in comics at all, let alone.
Well, we had the luxury on the West Coast of having the animation business. And as I told you, I went to work at Marvel Superheroes, which when you look at it now, it's like, God, that stuff is clunky. But it was a first for the time. But the next thing we did was the first Saturday morning animated Spider-Man show. And I was the only person at this studio who had even ever read a Spider-Man comic book. And I had such a rapport with Grant Simmons, who was Grant Ray Lawrence, and worked almost exclusively with this director. And I worked part-time at home. He wanted me, believe it or not, to be do the voice work for Peter Parker / Spider-Man. But Lawrence had signed a contract with a non-union outfit, Trillium, in Canada to do all the voices, but he wanted me to be Spider-Man. Whatever that's worth. That was a terrible decision. I worked 20 hours a week. This is when I was working with Russ Manning getting started with Gold Key Comics. And I came in after the third week, and Grant Simmons says, Mike, you are in trouble. And I said, why? He said, because the 20 hours a week work that you're turning in is equal to the 40 hours a week of the people on staffs. I said, well, what I'll do is just charge me for 40.
Yes. Nice.
That's pretty good. We got about, time. We got about 4 or 5 minutes here. Somebody have a question that want me to put the panel? Yes, sir.
I do, primarily for Walt. I really did admire the Manhunter series that you worked on in the 1970s. It's really then and now an amazing piece of work. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what your process was in creating and developing that work with Archie Goodwin and what it was like to work with Archie.
The question was, I couldn't hear what it was. Ben's a fan of the Manhunter series that Walt did with Archie, as are we all. And he'd like to know, could Walt talk a little bit about what was the process of working with Archie on a feature like that?
I'll try to give as quick an answer as I can. I've worked with a lot of phenomenal writers, with the guys at this table. I hope none of them will take offense. I don't think I've ever worked with a writer that somehow I was more in tune with, or he with me, than we did on Manhunter when Archie and I worked on that together. Don't quite know why. It was just something about the, I hate to use the word synergy, but I will, the synergy between the two of us on that strip. Archie's idea. He wanted to do a strip to go in the back of Detective Comics. That would be sort of the antithesis of Batman, where Batman was a guy in the city, Manhunter would be a guy for whom the world was the stage, where Batman was mostly unarmed combat, plus little gizmos in his belt. Manhunter was, you know, knives and guns and other stuff. The costume, Batman was gray and blue, Manhunter would be bright red, sort of as a beacon, really. So we did a lot of stuff. The main thing I can say about process and that, I can say more about it, but what it comes down to is Archie really wrote 20-page stories that we crammed into 8 pages. And when you do that, you put a lot of panels on a page. And so I learned how to put 12, 13, 14, 15 panels on a page. I believe Gil Kane once critiqued a fight sequence I did. Not to me. I talked with Howard Chaykin, I believe, that too many panels. There's too many panels on this page. But really, a lot of the look of that strip and a lot of the feel of it came out of the necessity, really, of trying to tell a story and trying to tell a lot of story in a fairly short form. And that's really how the kind of look of the strip and maybe the pacing of it developed. In the beginning, we worked what was called DC style. Archie wrote full scripts. By the end of it, if I had any talent in comics, it was not drawing. It was really breaking things down into moments and storytelling. By the end of that strip, we were doing it Marvel style, where I would do a breakdown from Archie's plot, and then Archie would script it for my layouts. So we changed over during the course of a little more than a year we worked on the strip. That's really, that's as much process I give you in a short form.
Here's a view that I have, and I wonder if anybody in the panel would disagree with this. I have never been really happy, that happy, with any comic book I've done, unless I had a relationship with the artist, that I knew I was a friend, I could call them, talk to them, have lunch with them. Did you ever have a complete, any a really satisfying experiences working with people that you just worked through an editor and never had any contact with?
Gee.
I have, you know, fairly often. If I could, you know, I don't know Alan Brenner really at all, but the scripts are absolutely brilliant. I've done two of them. Two of the best work I've ever done. I can't think of anything I enjoy more. And there was no personal contact at all.
Cool. All right. Anybody else have an experience? Just working? Len, did you ever write a script that was drawn by someone you never met and you were really happy with how the art came out?
The answer is almost certainly yes. I've not met a number of the artists with whom I worked. A lot of people work in York, for example, these days. But I got some beautiful artwork. I did a Western story for an anthology from Image that came out just recently called, oh boy, I can't remember the name of it. But I did an old Western story just to get a chance to write a Western. And the artist is someone I've never met and did a magnificent job. It's exactly what I envisioned. Okay. In fact, even more so.
Would anyone like to support my premise?
I will say that I work. My very early scripts, and my first book was by a guy named Len Wein, whom I'd never met at the time. It was handed to me by the editor. It was a nice story. I was happy with it. It wasn't my best art, but it was the best I could do at the time.
Yeah,
I will say that mostly after I entered the business, I worked very hard to work with people that I knew personally and whose work I liked a lot. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do that so that I haven't had the chance much to work with guys I didn't know and have been able to work, have some kind of personal relationship with. I just had that make for better stories, really.
Okay.
Anybody else want to?
Well, I don't know if this is what you.
So just the first point. The book was Outlaw Territory. I just remember the name of the anthology. All right.
Anybody else have one? We are out of time. I wish we could make this 90 minutes. We'll make this 90 minutes next year. Come back to it. Would you join me in thanking Mr. Walsh, Simon Smith?